U.S. President Donald Trump indicates he is looking forward to a White House meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Given Ankara's widely condemned invasion of Kurdish territory in northern Syria, the visit figures to be controversial. No hint of that from Mr. Trump.
President Erdogan wants to come to the White House. We have a very good relationship. The ceasefire has held very nicely. We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home.
In Mali, the government says at least 53 of its soldiers and one civilian were killed in a Friday jihadist attack on the army in the north of the country. The original death toll was at least 15. Mali's communication minister says 10 survivors were found at the army post in the Manaka region. The new violence could ratchet up tensions in the capital, Bamako, where military families have argued there is inadequate protection from Mali's soldiers. The government says reinforcements have been dispatched to secure the area and hunt down the attackers. So far, no claim of responsibility. Hong Kong police today once again fired tear gas to break up the latest pro-democracy street demonstrations in the Chinese semi-autonomous territory. Meanwhile, China's Basic Law Commission for Hong Kong and Macau is warning that Beijing will not permit what it calls behavior that encourages separatism or endangers national security. It also claimed that foreign powers were interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong. Security forces in Iraq are on alert after Friday's massive anti-government street demonstration in Baghdad's Tahrir Square, the largest in weeks of political unrest. The death toll over the past month is said to number 250, including 5 people who died Friday of wounds sustained earlier. From Washington, this is VOA News. The United Nations is calling for greater protection for journalists as the world observes an international day to end impunity for crimes against journalists. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, reports 1,360 journalists have been killed since 1993. The non-governmental Press Emblem Campaign reports 65 journalists worldwide have been killed so far this year. In addition, it notes that journalists in many countries are regularly molested, injured, harassed, detained, and prevented from doing their work. The campaign supports the enactment of an international convention for the protection of journalists to combat impunity more effectively. It cites the case of Mexico as a country where impunity is almost total because of the corruption of local authority.
That report was filed for VOA by Lisa Schlein in Geneva. The Press Emblem campaign also singles out Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, and Iraq, where it says crimes against journalists go unpunished. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has given the United States until the end of the year to become more flexible on nuclear talks. Since then, he's launched 12 rounds of missiles to back up that warning, including a launch Thursday. And as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, some observers say the current impasse could soon get much more volatile.
Lee Byung-cho, a professor at Seoul's Kyungnam University, says there's a significant chance things will soon get worse on the Korean Peninsula, citing North Korea's recent statements. Last week, North Korea warned that the U.S. is seriously mistaken if it ignores its end-of-year deadline. It also warned against using the relationship between U.S. President Donald Trump and Kim as a delaying tactic. Moo Jin-young, with the University of North Korean Studies, says if there isn't a third Trump-Kim summit planned by the end of the year, and if there's no other tangible progress in nuclear talks, North Korea will likely conduct a long-range missile or nuclear test.
That was VOA's Bill Gallo reporting from Seoul. Backed by tens of thousands of protesters, Pakistan's opposition parties on Friday demanded the country's prime minister resign within 2 days. Demonstrators in Islamabad accused Prime Minister Imran Khan of destroying the country's economy and stealing the last election with the help of the military. The United States says for the time being, nationals from 6 countries will be allowed to stay in the U.S. under a special humanitarian status. Involved are the nations of El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nepal, Nicaragua, and Sudan. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The population needs to involve themselves to support also the army. So there's not a real concrete reaction from the government. The government is today, as we said, is powerless.
At least 54 people die in a militant attack on a Malian northern military post Friday.
There are allegations that there was massive fraud in the elections. That has no substance. That has no evidence. In fact, there were threats that the opposition would have filed a court application to even interdict the inauguration. That did not happen. And I believe it didn't happen because there is just no evidence that there was any vote rigging.
Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi is sworn in to begin his first five-year term.
It's important for all leaders to show respect for the freedom of the press and also show their tolerance and respect for the work that journalists are doing. Freedom of expression and free media are essential to our democracies.
And the world observes International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists Saturday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Malian government says 53 soldiers and one civilian were killed in a militant attack on a northern military post. The assault, which occurred Friday, is one of the deadliest in recent jihadist violence. Yaya Sangare, Mali's communication minister, said 10 survivors were found at the army post in the Indelimani Menaka region, adding that the situation is under control. Meanwhile, there has been no immediate claim of responsibility. For the latest development, I reach Mamadou Tapili, an independent journalist in the capital, Bamako.
All Mali is aware of what happened Friday night. And only a month ago, the same case happened in Malian Army Forces base in Mondoro and Burkesi, where the Mali Army has lost about like 40 people and a lot of materials, a lot of munitions. So worried on being how come that practically simultaneously attacks could be happening in Malian bases. And that's happened on two bases at the same time, with the case of Mondoro and Burkesi. Just by a month, the same case happened again, where we lost again 53 soldiers. That's without counting the lost materials, civilian skills, and all these things. So people are wondering what's really happening. It is a plot against the Malian army, or many people are really on the social media, in the town, everybody. People are thinking, by the way, they can find a solution and really find out what's really going on.
What has been the reaction of the government following this attack? Because the government confirms that about 54 people have died as a result of this so-called jihadist attack.
Yeah, as usual, the government usually, they just condemn. As usual, whenever these kind of things happen, we condemn. The reinforced soldier has been sent, so the area is on control, while the jihadists have already finished the attack and they're gone, while people are already killed, the ammunition has been taken away. So that's always what the government is doing on condemning and condemning. But there is not a solution. The problem is not there. The problem is that the populations in Mali are wondering what's really going on. How come the camp, the different Malian post bases are being targeted like this way by the jihadist people? And how come on in a sensitive place as in the north or in the center, where the jihadists are the Malian army are fighting, how come most of the time, even in month time, they've been always surprisingly attacked by the jihadists? How come that happens? The question is there.
Has the government been able to answer these questions by Malians, particularly residents of the areas where these jihadist attacks usually occur?
The government is calling for a lot of vigilance for the armed forces, and then how to support them, with whatever they have been said, but to support them, that the population needs to involve themselves to support also the army. So there's not a real concrete reaction from the government. The government is today, as we said, is powerless.
Mamadou Tapile is an independent Malian journalist. He spoke with me from Bamako. On Friday, Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi was sworn in to begin his first five-year term. This following the major election victory of his governing Botswana Democratic Party in the October general election. His installation makes Masisi the fifth democratically elected president of the Southern African country. But former President Serete Kama Iyenkama is coming under criticism for failing to attend his predecessor's installation, despite an official invitation from the government. For the latest development, I reach attorney Antonio Morima in the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
I think the installation would go down in history as one of the most memorable because there are throves and throves of people, thousands and thousands of people who came to witness the event. This year it was held at a sport complex at the University of Botswana, which allowed many people to come. You could feel it. You could just see it even on the media that people were happy. People were in a celebratory mood in that regard. And also this year, a difference is that even in various parts of the country, there have been arrangements for people to witness the inauguration through various big screens and et cetera. And if social media is to go by, it shows that there was a huge attendance indeed.
People that I have spoken with appear to say that the refusal or the non-attendance of former President Serete Kama Iyenkama was somewhat surprising. What is your assessment?
In fact, to the best of my knowledge, I know that there had been arrangement for the former president, Lieutenant General Dr. Serete Kama Iyenkama, to attend. The information I have is that he himself chose not to attend. In fact, release from his party, the Botswana Patriotic Front, to the extent that he will not be attending. I think it's a disappointing conduct by the former president because one would think that even if we may differ politically, even if there may be differences, even personally, when it comes to such a national event as the inauguration of the president, a former president would at least feel, from a national point of view, obliged to attend just to show that spirit of togetherness, spirit of unity. And to the extent that the former president chose not to attend, I think it's disappointing indeed.
If I may ask you, what do you see as the relationship going forward, particularly with his refusal not to attend the installation and his fallout with Masisi over policy differences going forward?
I think the relationship has almost reached levels where it cannot be salvaged. When it initially started, many people were hoping, even praying, that the two leaders would reconcile for the sake of our people. But it appears as time goes by, they become more and more apart from one another. From the press release that the former president issued, or his party issued, one of the reasons that he's giving is that the current president has coerced people to come and attend the inauguration to give an impression that he's a popular person. In fact, he goes to the extent of even alleging that the military or the BDF was used to make sure that people attend in large numbers. There is no empirical evidence to support his assertion. I think many Botswana came because they can see a sense of hope in the current president, President Masisi. I think people attended because they feel duty-bound to come and celebrate the installation or inauguration of a president, especially one that brings hope for them, for their life.
What do you make of the electoral victory of the ruling or the governing BDP following its massive showing at the just-ended election? And some people suggest that it is a rejection of the former president's interference or influence after resigning from the party and promising and campaigning for the opposition in the run-up to the election.
I think it is threefold. Firstly, it is exactly that some people really decided that they're going to vote for President Dr. Masisi in order to show the former president that they don't dance to his tune. In other words, he is the one who made President Masisi president, and they are saying it's not a situation whereby if he suddenly doesn't want, they also should follow suit. Secondly, the victory was also necessitated by the weak opposition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, especially to the extent that just towards the elections, it expelled one of its member parties, the Botswana Movement for Democracy. As you know, there is another opposition party, the Alliance for Progressives, which stood a solo outside the UDC. I think the weakness of the UDC, and also the fact that the Masisi factor itself played a part, because unlike the former president, he came and rekindled the BDP. He pushed an agenda which he called a rebirth of the UDC. He reconciled with media, trade unions. He reconciled with workers. And those, I think, contributed in the numbers that the BDP got in the polls that just ended. There are allegations that there was massive fraud in the elections. That has no substance. That has no evidence. In fact, there were threats that the opposition would have filed a court application to even interdict the inauguration. That did not happen. And I believe it didn't happen because there is just no evidence that there was any vote rigging.
Anthony Morima is an attorney in Botswana. He spoke with me from Habaroni. The Secretary General of the South African Opposition Party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, says a court was right to uphold the Constitution's guarantee of free speech. Godrich Gardi was reacting to a court's ruling which dismissed a charge of hate speech against Julius Malema, leader of the EFF. Malema is alleged to have called Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan a dog of white monopoly capital. The opposition leader blames the minister for what many believe are his tax challenges when Gordhan was the finance minister. For additional reaction to the court's ruling, I reach Godrich Gardi, Secretary General for the EFF.
Leaders of political parties have political rights, and particularly leaders of opposition parties have got no any other tool to hold the ruling party accountable except through robust political speeches.
But someone would ask you, why will the leader call somebody a dog of white monopoly capital? What did he want to achieve by that statement?
Well, he never invented the word dog to be used metaphorically as he did. You know that there is even a proverb which says dog has its own day, including you yourself, Chief Sir. The day you just have to come across something very spectacular, your friends and everybody will cheer you up and say every dog has its own day. That is not an insult. It is metaphorically used. And it cannot be said to be literally meaning that he is a barking dog. It is a metaphorically used word and language in a robust political landscape.
Well, some of his critics are saying they understand he has freedom of speech as enshrined in the South African Constitution. But some of his statements are quite divisive, abrasive, and cause unnecessary tension and division among the South African society. So they expect him as a leader, a prominent leader of a party and a member of parliament as well, to behave in accordance with the term honorable, as they said. How do you respond to such criticism?
The political space is by nature not a church environment. It is an arena and a landscape where it is it me, it you. It is very robust and critical. And if the heat is too much in the kitchen, you must leave it. You must know it's no longer politics. It is a church service or a memorial service. There is no decorum in politics. In politics, we call a spade a spade. The minority white settlers of Europe are in charge of 100% of the economy of the country at the exclusion of the 57 million people in South Africa. We shall say it so, that the whites are in charge and they are monopolizing capital. And any other person from our own ranks who is a non-black and a non-white, which is protecting the whites to keep the economy and the capital of this country in the hands of the minorities who are white settlers in this country, we shall say so. And if to you That is creating tension and disharmony. It is the same tension and disharmony that was created by the settlers when they first landed in this country, the same white settlers who actually coined and implemented racial discrimination and economic exploitation of the indigenous people.
Well, Gadi, some people are saying your party appears to be targeting the former finance minister Gordhan as being the person who created the tax irregularities that you speak about. Why are you targeting him? And some of the statements that you just made, some are saying, are quite racially insensitive. Your response to that?
The matter is that Mr. Pravin Gordhan has got directorship and shares in all the multinational conglomerates and international corporates that are operating in South Africa. He's a stooge on security of foreign capital and the white capital. He is a security guard and is being used by capital to actually disengage the African people. We will never stop in criticizing him. We will definitely tell him that until actually it comes to an end. And it will soon come to an end.
Godrich Gadi is the Secretary General for the South African Opposition Party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. Wilson Sossion, the Secretary General for the Kenyan National Union of Teachers, has rejected as inconsequential the cancellation of his license. The move prevents him from ever teaching students in the country. Sossion is in Parliament representing teachers following a recommendation by the opposition Orange Democratic Movement. He says the cancellation of his certificate is petty. His remarks came after Nancy Macaria, Chief Executive Officer of the Teacher Service Commission, said Sossion's name has been removed from the register of the country's teachers. Sossion tells me the move does not have any impact on his position as the Secretary General for the Kenyan National Union of Teachers.
That is an illegal action because the matter is in court and it is personalized. Because by removing me from the register, I automatically cease being Secretary General. That is the objective. They know too well I will not at any time go and teach in any school. And I am released officially from the Teacher Service Commission to the Kenya National Union of Teachers, and they know too well I'm the Secretary General on leave. So an employer cannot purport to discipline a Secretary General of a union that represents employees. It amounts to intimidation and lack legitimacy in what they're doing, because every degazettement since I'm a member of parliament from a political party, there are many unionists in parliament who still represent teachers, particularly from COPED, the three members of parliament. I've not seen them removed from the register and degazetted. Why does it apply to me? It's actually misinformed, malicious, and politically motivated action.
So what recourse do you have regarding the action she took?
Well, the matter is in court because this gazettement is one of the series of actions she has been engaged in. So the matter is in court and proper direction will be given. It comes up on Thursday as a matter of the Court of Appeal. It is even wrong for her to engage in such an action, which is a consequence of a judgment that is under appeal, whose notice of appeal has been filed and is listed for hearing under 524B of the Court of Appeal.
You described her action as inconsequential. However, she argues that you seem to
it's
be carrying
completely inconsequential because it doesn't change my position as a Secretary General. The objective they have, it doesn't affect my status as a Secretary General. I continue as long as I'm elected and registered by the Register of Trade Unions in accordance with the labor laws. The Register of Teachers does not determine who becomes the Secretary General of the union. That's what I said is inconsequential.
Your critics are saying that the action she took was legitimate because you are not fighting for teachers in parliament, but you are carrying out the ODMs, the political party.
Those are political arguments, and those are her allies. You know, in any debate, they are allies of both sides.
I understand that. So what's your next line of action with this action she's taking?
No, of course, the matter is legitimately in court, so the court will dispense of it. Why would I bother so much? Because in any case, it doesn't affect my work and my status. It doesn't at all. But for legitimacy and to avoid setting precedent of attacking individuals through misuse of offices, it is a matter that is lined up for substantive determination in court.
The report suggests that the TSC seems to have exploited a recent ruling after Employment and Labor Relations Court declared that it has the right to remove you from its role.
Pardon? It is a matter that is up for appeal at the Court of Appeal. That is one. Two, another ruling was delivered recently at the Employment and Labor Relations Court, which clarified my legitimacy as the Secretary General. That it cannot be affected by what TSC is doing. There are facts of law that have been pronounced by the same Employment and Labor Relations Court. And the action by TSC today is contempt of that direction.
Wilson Sosion is the Secretary General for the Kenyan National Union of Teachers. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. The United Nations and human rights defenders are calling for greater protection for journalists as the world observes this year's International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The gruesome murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul last year is a textbook case of impunity. The Saudi Arabian assassins and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who allegedly commissioned the killing, have paid no price for this crime. Many other killings of journalists also go unpunished. In his message on this International Day, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres deplores the rise in the scale and number of attacks against the physical safety of journalists and media workers in recent years. Réal Leblanc is the UN's Chief of Press and External Relations in Geneva. He tells VOA that Guterres warns that world leaders who vilify journalists as purveyors of so-called fake news put the journalists' lives and liberty in danger.
And I think he said on many, many occasions how it's important for all leaders to show respect for the freedom of the press and also show their tolerance and respect for the work that journalists are doing. Freedom of expression and free media are essential to our democracies.
UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, reports 1,360 journalists have been killed since 1993. The non-governmental Press Emblem Campaign reports 65 journalists worldwide have been killed so far this year. In addition, it notes that journalists in many countries are regularly molested, injured, harassed, detained, and prevented from doing their work. The campaign supports the enactment of an international convention for the protection of journalists to combat impunity more effectively. It cites the case of Mexico as a country where impunity is almost total because of the corruption of local authorities. It says most crimes against journalists in other countries, such as Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, and Iraq, go unpunished because of the lack of an independent judiciary. It argues that independent international investigation and prosecution mechanisms are needed to identify those responsible for these crimes and bring them to justice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, and Mark Simakovsky, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council, discuss with host Carol Castiel the ramifications of the ongoing impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump after a crucial congressional vote approved the rules for a public phase. Listen for it on Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Ken Cuccinelli, the acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, recently announced new measures which could affect immigrant green card holders. The move will deny green cards and visas to immigrants who use government benefits. The benefits include food stamps, housing vouchers, and Medicaid. Meanwhile, critics say the new rules would have a chilling effect on many immigrant communities across the country. To understand the new rules and what the remedies or recourse immigrants can take, Simone Williams, founder and managing attorney at Williams Global Law, joins me live at the viewing studios here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Simone.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you.
All right, so tell me, what are your views about the new measures being implemented? Some supporters say it is to tighten the immigration system so people will not take advantage of it. But what is the latest development with risk?
Well, with respect to this rule, so let's talk about it a little bit. It's a public charge rule. It's denying, as you said, benefits. Well, it's saying that people who are green card holders, as known as permanent residents of the United States, if they are seeking such benefits, then they would be denied potentially a green card. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that if you have been seen to be using federal benefits when you're about to apply to get a green card now, and for people who are going to get a green card to get the final approval, that they would be potentially denied a green card when they're seeking to get a green card. And they're saying that the factors include people who earn less than 125%, less than the poverty level.
Right.
Those who can't speak English, those who have large debts, those who use food stamps, those who are using housing assistance or Medicaid. And essentially, they're saying that basically, if you are a U.S. immigrant, a permanent resident of the United States, and you're looking to become a U.S. permanent resident, that you shouldn't be, you should be denied these benefits, if this is what you are. I mean, this is a bit, this is unlike anything we've seen ever in history. And because it's everyone's up in arms about it, it's actually being blocked by three federal judges in three states, New York, California, and Washington. It's not become effect because of the legislation. There's a nationwide injunction right now concerning this rule. So everyone is up in, a lot of people are up in arms about it, of course, because this is something that's unprecedented. This has not happened before.
There's a new rule, I understand, where immigrants who want to come to the country would have to demonstrate that they have an ability to purchase healthcare or insurance.
Right. So
talk to me about that.
So that's another extension of, I guess, this making sure that immigrants do not become dependent on the federal system, the mm-hmm. healthcare system, the public benefit system, et cetera. So now they're saying that if you're looking to become a permanent resident and you've become approved to become a permanent resident, the process is that you have to go to an interview mm-hmm. at the local embassy in your country. And you're at that point, you have to identify whether you in fact have health insurance or you're going to have it in the reasonable foreseeable future, which means within 30 days. So in effect, the way that works is that they actually have to demonstrate that they're going to be purchasing healthcare. They've identified a provider for the healthcare. So these are the types of things that, people are like, what? We need healthcare right now. That's as part of becoming a U.S. permanent resident, a green card holder. These are the requirements. That itself is a rule that was the president had a presidential proclamation on October 4th. Mm-hmm. And it's actually going into effect on November 3rd. which is tomorrow.
So tell me how, talk to me about the implementation. How will this be implemented if somebody demonstrates the ability that, okay, I have money, I'll be able to purchase it there. Mm-hmm. What happens if they get here and are unable for some reason mm-hmm. to implement mm-hmm. it? How
within the 30 days?
Yes.
Well, it's not. There's not much detail right now at this point as to how it's actually going to be implemented and enforced. Because, I mean, what we do know right now is that the officers will be asking questions concerning whether you have health insurance, and you have to identify, you know, the provider, and, you know, the more detail that you have, the better, because that's now going to be used as a reason not to approve your green card or your permanent resident application. So in my opinion, as an attorney, I would have to advise my clients that they need to make sure that they have identified health insurance and that it will go into effect in the pretty quickly upon arrival to the U.S.
So what about those who usually would invite their old parent mm-hmm. To come and visit? Mm-hmm. Usually these people are pensioners or mm-hmm. they've retired from their jobs. Mm-hmm. How would this be in terms of the implementation, and how would you advise somebody to meet these requirements as the U.S. government has put in place?
Well, yes. So those individuals who are on pension may be potentially in their own countries, you mean? Mm-hmm. So this rule, this healthcare rule, is only applicable to those who are going to be immigrants of the United States. And by immigrants, we mean people who are permanently residing in the U.S. It does not affect students, temporary visitors, people who are just here for a temporary period of time, or even on a work visa that's temporary. But once you get this document called a green card, that's when you become a U.S. permanent resident of the United States. That's when this rule will apply to you, and it applies to everybody across the board, no matter what the basis of how you became a green card holder. If it was business, employment, family, asylum, anything, this rule will apply to you.
So what about those who just want to acquire visas to come and visit and return home?
Yeah, that's...
Will that affect them as well?
No, it doesn't affect those. The U.S. Immigration rules legislation, they have the terms which they call non-immigrants. Those are temporary visitors, temporary residents, temporary workers, et cetera, and those who are immigrants. And when we think about immigrants, we think about everyone, right? But mm-hmm. immigrants means in the U.S. terminology, U.S. immigration terminology, people who are permanently living in the United States and mm-hmm. have a green card, have this document that allows them to live here mm-hmm. permanently.
Live and work here.
Live and work in the United States, yes.
Permanently. All right, so let me ask you about your overall view about the state of immigration in the mm-hmm. U.S.
Okay. As we know, since the new administration has taken, has been in power, it's become obviously tightened immigration regime, stricter rules. Things are happening all the time. We had a travel ban that's affected three African countries. And it's, I would say, unpredictable, because as an immigration attorney, things were, as I've been practicing for 15 years, things were pretty much predictable. It's a regulatory industry where there's rules and we abide by the rules and we are able to help our clients to get the benefits that they are seeking. But now we have, you know, unexpected changes, unprecedented changes, new rules that's never happened. And what we see as well is there's been a significant increase and delay in the processing of all applications across the board. The delays, people are taking much longer to get benefits. Things are taking longer. There's higher scrutiny across the board. So, I mean, right now, that's the climate that we have in the United States concerning immigration. But that's all to say that, you know, with changes, we have to be able to, you know, do what we can to meet the new requirements, help those clients that need our assistance to provide them with all of the advice they need so they're able to overcome and work within what these higher scrutiny new regulations. So we're doing our best as lawyers, as immigration attorneys, but I mean, it's hard to say because there's always something new all the time, it seems. There's a new rule coming, the healthcare, the public charge rule, the travel ban, you know, it's obviously immigration is a hot topic. It's something that this administration is trying to tighten against those who are seeking to enter the United States.
You know, some supporters are saying that for a long time, the U.S. immigration system has been taken advantage of, so there was need for it to be tightened. But as an attorney who deals with this every day, when clients come to you, how are you able to explain this to them about the new changes and the new rules and the need for them to meet those rules in order to get the benefits that you spoke about?
I mean, it's interesting because statistics actually show that immigrants, foreign-born workers, have are higher educated or are better contributors to society, unfortunately, because, you know, they're coming here, they're working hard. And so that idea that, you know, they need to be more strict on them is actually not facts. I mean, the fact is they have contributed greatly to the U.S. economy and do and perform work that maybe the U.S. citizens don't want to do. So, but as far as providing my clients with advice, I mean, we could only review the regulations, the new rules, and offer the best advice we can. A lot of these rules are very new, and there's very little on what we can expect because we don't know how they're going to implement the rule. But in that case, based on our advice and our expertise, we could just, you know, do the best we can and help people navigate the new process and the new regime.
Well, reading a bit about immigration, I understand there's an EB-5. What is it? Tell me about it. And what does it entail? How is it implemented? How is it enforced? Talk to me about it.
Okay, so there's a program in the United States that's, I guess we're switching to a bit of more positive in the sense that there is a program in the U.S. that allows high net worth foreign investors to invest $500,000 in the United States in projects and companies that are creating jobs, 10 jobs per investor for American workers. So this is a job creation program. It also facilitates the ability for someone who can make that type of investment to come here to the United States immediately. And when I say immediately, within 2 years or so, but become immediately a permanent resident of the United States. So it's something that's been utilized in high numbers by certain regions. I would say in the African region, not so much. In the past, it's been a lot of investors we've seen from China, from Vietnam, from Asian countries, as well as India. But, you know, this is an interesting program. So if you're able to afford it, you could come and invest $500,000 and become a green card holder. It covers yourself and your spouse and children under the age of 21. So a lot of investors do this maybe for their families and able to, you know, to live in a relatively stable economy compared to their economies or their countries. But what I do want to say is that the rule, which was always since 1990, has the investment amount has been $500,000, is now going to increase to $900,000.
When does this begin?
November 21st.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's another thing that's changed. That change itself is not actually, they've been saying that for a long time, for a while, for about 3 or 4 years at least. So that's not a complete shock that it's increasing. It hasn't increased since 1990. And other similar programs around the world, such as Canada, Australia, Portugal, they have higher investment amounts. So it's not that shocking. But that being said, you know, from 500,000 to 900 is a lot. So anybody who's interested in doing that, should contact an attorney that could help them get a green card through EB-5.
Well, Simon will continue with this some other time. Simon Williams is the founder and managing attorney at Williams Global Law here in Washington, D.C. She joined us live from the VOA studios here in Washington. And right now it's time for music from African Collection. You're hearing Mafi Kizolo featuring Diamond Platnumz and DJ Maforiza with Colors of Africa. Sanapai Tande with Amina Abizi featuring Davido with Shushu. And then Adina featuring Sa Kodie with Makoma will end it all for us.
Yeah. West Africa, winning team, Calera winner, killing the beast to America, chilling me home here for Tanzania.
Bisha yangu madhambi kwa hivyo naomba siku hii nikumbukie mazuri nataka mcheke siku ya mwisho usiwe mpweke mibadiliko na mshukuru Mola kwa kuwepo nasema amina 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 amina
mpenzi panguza chozi sijijaze choki wewe moyoni hasira hasara yote ya mwenyezi oh rafiki panguza chozi sijumize wikichwa na maswali nitasame sana kwenza bila mkono waburieni wakati hauniruhusu mimi kurekebisha yangu madhambi kwa hivyo naomba siku hii nikumbukie mazuri nataka mcheke siku ya mwisho usiwe mpweke mibadiliko na mshukuru Mola kwa kuwepo nasema amina amina amina
Wakati hauniruhusu mimi kurekebisha yangu madhambi kwa hivyo naomba siku hii nikumbukie mazuri nataka mcheke siku ya mwisho usiwe mpweke mibadiliko na mshukuru Mola kwa kuwepo nasema amina amina amina
Amina, 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 amina. Get busy from Freetown to Lagos.
Sweetie. do not your fan. Unfuni na dama koma so. Girl, I wanna love you to the end of time. May your body cross the street, my son. Yeah, so don't be surprised if I kill myself all in the name of love. Me and I may be pair, will let me pay the price. So I dream it, see me team while I'm filled with raw. Beauty lies in the eyes of beholder. Oh, home to girl, I'm sober. And kind of life, I don't be chasing my door and it's over. Since I'm my irresponsible, me bomb over as a soldier. Jaina woman, kind of winning, brand your name, a soldier. Can be betrayed.
Just you know,
that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, however much it rains on you, no wild banana tree will grow on your head. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall.